Hands up, beloved listener, if you've been to Trent and Strea lately for your holidays. If you have, we'd love to hear from you. It's one of the few places none of us involved with the program have been to, and we'll find out exactly where it is in a minute. But it's very unique, as it's recognised by no other country in the world. And wait for this, it doesn't accept that the Soviet Union no longer exists. Writer Rory MacLean, who was with us a little while ago, we were discussing that terrific book of his, Berlin, Imagine a City, which was named one of the top 10 books of 2014 by the Washington Post. Congratulations, Rory. And so I want to find out about this strange place. Rory's new book is called Back in the USSR, Heroic Adventures in Transnistria, and I don't have a physical copy of the book, only a PDF file, which I'm sure doesn't do the photographs justice, but boy, they're great shots and it does look pretty bleak. Rory, welcome back. And
thank you,
as you probably remember, I do call this program Lennon L tonight. It seems wholly and utterly appropriate. Is the place as bleak as the photographs portray?
Nick Danziger's photographs are just wonderful, and they just capture the spirit of Transnistria. It is quite a remarkable place, Transnistria. It's a puppet state created by former Red Army officers, Russian oligarchs, and the KGB. They've got their fingers in every pie in the aftermath of the fall of the wall, the Berlin Wall.
Where exactly is it, Rory, for the geographically challenged?
Well, look, it challenges me, too. It challenges many people. It's part of a breakaway republic of the old Soviet Union. It's on the for the geographers among your listeners, it's on the eastern fringe of Moldova, the resurrected, if you like, country of Moldova, which interestingly, for those who can begin to picture where it is, that means it's on the western flank of Ukraine. And as we well know, there's all sorts of terrible things happening on the eastern flank of Ukraine.
Well, you're irrepressible, and you describe it as being 1,685 miles from Harrods, 2,315 miles from Monaco, and 800 miles from Moscow. Beautifully positioned. No bigger than Devon or Rhode Island.
Yes, that's right. I just had a look. Three Transnistrias would fit into the greater Sydney metropolitan area. You could get 20 of them into Tasmania. It's a tiny place. It did have, right after the fall of the Berlin Wall, so in the early 1990s, there were about 800,000 people living there. But so many people. One shouldn't laugh, but it's so... You couldn't make this up. Really, Philip, you couldn't make this up.
Well, I think you have. I think this whole segment is... I'm having my leg pulled by my producers. I'm being suckered into this. I played the national anthem, which has to be the most appalling dirge I've ever heard, with the worst lyrics.
It stirs the heart. Surely, Philip, your heart was stirred by that.
No. It's Monty Python-esque. But, okay, so the population is shrinking.
Yes.
And what has done this? Alcohol seems to have been a factor.
Well, yes, as in much of the Slavic world, alcohol is rather key to the society, and it certainly hasn't contributed to increasing the population. Fascinating aside, when Chairman Gorbachev banned or reduced alcohol just in the mid-80s, there was a boom in births in the old Soviet Union, because late at night, those cold nights on the steps, what else was a poor man or a poor woman to do? And so there was this blossoming of Soviet children. But then after Gorbachev, all the restrictions on alcohol stopped, and as we now know, birth rates in the area of the former Soviet Union are desperately low.
I understand you were asked to go there by the International Committee of the Red Cross, Rory. Why was that?
It's a little different. We were told about it by an officer from the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross. He had originally gone there to inspect the prisons, and which is what the ICRC does, and to make sure prisoners are well looked after. And he discovered that the not only was the head of the prison service in Transnistria, not only was he a former Red Army officer who had led the tanks into Prague in 1968, but he was an enthusiastic collector of animals. He had a private zoo, if you like. You know, how ironic.
That's an extension of the prison system, I guess.
Exactly. And it was so within the prison compound, there were cages of... no, there was no elephant, but there was donkeys and cobras. There was an emu, all in very, very cold weather. And when we heard about this, when myself and Nick Danziger heard this story, we thought, this is for us. We have to discover Transnistria.
How did you get there? How did you get a visa to get there?
Well, a great achievement in my life. No other foreign writer, other than Russian writers, have spent more than a couple of days in Transnistria. Well, I, Philip, I have spent almost a month there. I take the record for the poor Western writer who spent the longest time there.
Were you under constant surveillance, Rory, when you were...
Oh, my God. How we got a visa was luckily the man from the ICRC. He knew his translator at the time had become the lover of the man who'd become the president. So we had a very useful in, shall we say.
Oh, dear.
And as for being followed, on our second or third night there, we suddenly saw ourselves on Transnistrian television. And we thought, oh, this is very nice. But we saw ourselves being interviewed on Transnistrian television. Rory MacLean says, Nick Danziger says, and this all over long shots of us walking down High Street Tiraspol, and we've been filmed secretly.
This is Lennon Allen. I'm talking to Rory about his latest book. You take us around with a tour guide who's the new Soviet man. Now, as a teenage member of the Communist Party, I'd like to hear more about the new Soviet man. Who is he?
Well, he has to go unnamed, I'm afraid, because, as I said, Transnistria was created. Its original purpose was to be a criminalized terra incognita. It was used, it is believed, for smuggling, trafficking weapons, people, and as you said in the introduction, to this day, for no great surprise, this Nowhere Land is unrecognized by any United Nations member state. So the powers that be in Transnistria are a small group of oligarchs and retired Red Army officers and ex-KGB men, and they run the show like new Soviet man.
You do a segue to the notion of Donald Trump. There's a touch of the Trumps about him.
Well, I think Donald Trump might be envious of some of the doors that are opened for within Transnistria for the oligarchs of Transnistria.
But you also talk about a great sense of national pride. You know, the people see themselves still as Soviet citizens.
Yes, on the cynical side, it is the only glue they have to hold Transnistria together, is this artificial creation, because it's a mixture of ethnic Russians, ethnic Ukrainians, and ethnic Moldovans. There is nothing that links them all apart from the relatively recent history of being part of the Soviet Union. So that is exploited, and that is celebrated in May Day parades, in the hammer and sickle on the national crest, on everyone wearing a red party badge. It is like
it sounds like a theme park.
you know, they could probably make now that a lot of the borders have been closed by the EU, they could not probably make a go of it as a theme park. It's a good idea, Philip.
Now, you report that the state budget clocks up a 70% deficit every year, Rory. Is there an economy?
Well, no. Everything that's not owned by the oligarchs and all, there's one company called Sheriff, which owns almost everything in the country. And it was set up by two ex-KGB officers who had been sheriffs for the former leader. And they own most of everything. The Transnistria is, to look at the geopolitical side, Transnistria is supported by Russia, even though Russia doesn't recognize it. There are 4,000...
I'm sorry, run that past me again. Russia doesn't recognize it.
It gets better and better. Yes, yes. So, Transnistria, as you said, does not recognize the collapse of the Soviet Union. So flip it around. But Russia and no one else recognizes Transnistria.
Doesn't Putin smile upon it?
Oh, yes, he does. Oh, this is part of President Putin's little plan. Yes, he does smile upon it. He provides every pensioner in the country with the Putin pension, $10 a week, and he has very kindly sent 4,000. Almost said Soviet, 4,000 Russian, quote-unquote, peacekeepers to protect the country from those terrible Moldovans, and Europeans are bound to invade at any moment. So it is, if you like, it was in a way Transnistria, which has existed now for more than 20 years, was his trial run for what he did in Crimea and is doing with much more brutality in the east of Ukraine.
I'm fascinated by the images that you're creating of, vestigial traces of the old USSR with statuary and hammers and sickles. And there really is a big May Day march?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the crest has the star on it and the hammer and sickle. The soldiers wear the old Soviet caps.
Look, there's a lot of old commos who listen to this program. After all, it is presented by one, and many of them will want to go there to retire. The Putin pension sounds good. What is it again? Ten rubles a week?
$10 a week. You know?
Well, heavens above.
It adds up.
Dear.
It was actually Transnistria's claim to fame during the Soviet Union days. It was the place where so many Red Army, retired Red Army officers
let's look at the other side, because you also celebrate the place. You say that everywhere we went, from schools to orphanages, factories to monasteries, we were welcomed with boundless hospitality and vodka. So talk about the generosity of spirit.
Of spirit, yes. We were treated very well on our month-long visit, and everywhere we went, as you say, we were welcomed with open arms and with vodka. You'd expect that, or it wouldn't be that much of a surprise when you went to somebody's house or even office at the end of the day. But for example, we went to a public school, at 10 o'clock in the morning, mid-morning break. We were invited into the staff room for sandwiches and vodka. And this went on day after day after day. It became so difficult for me to keep my notes, because I handwrite my notes, and to do that when not quite sober excuse me, was an increasing challenge. On one of our last days, we went to a monastery.
What brand of monastery, I have to ask?
It's Orthodox monastery.
So the Orthodox religion was, I guess, a collaborator with the state as it was in the old Soviet.
Indeed. But since Transnistria's resurrection, it's now supposedly independent. But we thought when we got there, thank goodness, we were spared alcohol for at least one morning. And as we were touring the monastery, of course, the abbot said, I just want to take you down to the cellar and let you see the altar wine. And there were barrels and barrels and barrels. And you can't say no, can you?
Well, right. I'm oddly enough, I'm virtually teetotal. I've forgotten that Gorbachev went on this sort of righteous rampage against grog, because he did it almost everywhere, didn't he? Closed factory bars, he banned alcohol at official functions.
That's right. That's right. He actually closed factory bars, or he prevented them from serving alcohol before mid afternoon. So before he put that instruction out, you could have. The heroic workers of the old Soviet Union could go and have a quick nip at 10:30 in the morning, or even earlier.
I must make the point that you don't make light of the tragedy of this country, or of other deeply serious matters, and you talk about decaying weapons stockpiles, corruption, yes, alleged human trafficking,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you yes. are always right with humour and compassion, don't you?
That I try to, for me, the best way for any of us to understand another place is to identify with and then empathize with the people who live there. So in all my books, and back in the USSR as number 10, I've written the stories of individuals and in the hope that the reader would identify with the individual, empathize with them, have a feeling of how their life, and so feel what it would be like to live in Transnistria, in this case.
Well, in a way, it'd be a bit like living in North Korea, wouldn't it, in a vestigial state?
Well, I also, funnily enough, went to North Korea with Nick Danziger last year, and we're putting together a book on that as well. So there were similarities. North Korea, it's, how to put this, there is something about the Slavic spirit and Slavic sense of humor that even in the darkest communist days, there was a bit of, it seems to me, a bit of tongue-in-cheek.
And there was also an oceanic sort of and rather beautiful melancholia, which seeps into the vodka culture. they are a wonderful people, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And North Korea, we were treated very well there as well, but if you like, that country has, I think, perfected Stalinism. There's not much humor about their political system.
We're talking about making it into a theme park. Would tourists like it if they could get in?
Transnistria?
Yeah.
Well, parts of the country are very beautiful, those without heavy industry or shut down heavy industry. The Dniester or Dniester River that goes through it is one of the main rivers of that part of the world. In fact, it can be considered the border between Europe and Asia. It's a very beautiful river. The infrastructure is not really there, Philip.
Yeah, but infrastructure doesn't take long. Oh, look, I've forgotten to ask you about the president. Tell us about Shevchuk.
Shevchuk. President Shevchuk, he took over a couple of years ago. Young man, very dynamic, and he very clever man. As soon as he took over, he got rid of all the gray Soviet bureaucrats and replaced them with Shevchuk. And Shevchuk, and I don't know if they're all old girlfriends, but I know that some of them are. But the minister,
the foreign minister is Nina Stansky, who was 34.
Then there's
a new minister of justice, a Maria Melnik, 30.
Right, thank you.
Heavens above.
But the remarkable thing, especially with Nina Shetansky, the foreign minister, is that as, of course, these very beautiful women are endowed with great intelligence as well. I'm not questioning that at all, and great presence. And in the case of Nina Shetansky, all the foreign ministers of Europe, having not surprisingly been very bored of the old grey Soviet bureaucrats, are lining up to meet her. So for an unrecognized state, it's a very shrewd move in that all these, although Transnistria is not being officially recognized, foreign ministers from
Rory, we've got to buy shares in this place. We can make a fortune out of this theme park. Gorgeous, you know, I mean, fantastic. Now, before you go, I want you to tell the listener about Unbound, your publisher, because it's a very interesting business model.
Unbound is fascinating, and this is they've published back in the USSR. I hope they will publish our book on North Korea later this year. I say publish. What it is, it's crowdfunding, and they put it on the website, and individuals pledge so much money, different levels of money, for an e-copy of the book, a hardback copy, a signed hardback copy, even if they spend, I think it's £150, an invitation for two to the launch party, as well as a copy of the hardback book. And so it is that the readers are financing the books directly.
And you point out that this is an idea from the late 18th century. We must have a chat about this later when the next book comes out, because I find it absolutely intriguing. Rory, thank you. Rory
My
McLean,
pleasure.
Traveller, explorer, writer of 10 books, and we've been discussing back in the USSR, photographs taken by Nick Danziger, and yes, published by Unbound. Now, on our next, we're going to do some travelling. We're staying in the region with Lithuania, and then to Israel to check on the election results before coming home to a great yarn about Australia's first Aboriginal Army officer, Reg Saunders. Are we going to go out with the national anthem? Please be upstanding, dear listeners, for the national anthem. It's news time now on RN. Talk to you shortly.